All right, so before I start, thanks to the organizers for letting me do this. And Dick, probably. Okay, so I'm Jonathan. I work on Hidden Universe technology with Vic Bond at CDOT, so I'm a grad student. And sort of on topic with what was discussed yesterday, I'm going to talk about producing density perturbations from preheating. In particular, how we can use caustics and entropy to figure out how you can make intermittent perturbations to the density field from the epoch of preheating. Okay. So, just to set the stage for what I'm going to talk about, okay, this is something that actually everyone here knows very well. Okay. What happened in the history of the universe? So you start way over on the left and one of the world. Something happened, quantum gravity. And you wait a while and inflation starts, okay. And then at some point, inflation has to end, and you go through a bunch more sort of unknown physics, where you probably have electroweak phase transitions, QCD phase transitions, that sort of stuff. At some point, you have nuclear synthesis. Eventually, you form the CMB, and then galaxies and stars turn on and everything. Okay. And so I'm going to be focusing on this time, basically, right here, which is when inflation ends and you start the normal standard hot big bang. Okay. So one way to think about what's going on is that during inflation, we basically have 1 degree of freedom. So there's a homogeneous amplitude field, some small fluctuations around it. Okay. So this is very cold. There are hardly any active degrees of freedom that are relevant. Okay. What you need to do is go from that state, that is very simple, into the primordial plasma, which is very hot, at least over an MeV, or you don't do nuclear synthesis, right? And you have to have many, many, many active degrees of freedom, okay? So obviously, there's a huge amount of entropy in going from zero temperature, zero entropy, to the universe plasma, okay? But we would like to know exactly how this happens, and of course, perhaps more importantly, is are there observational signatures from this transition, okay? So one thing that maybe gives you hope that you will get a signature is that this can be a very, very long time. Okay. So what basically happens is by this model, so let's just take a simple model for how this transition is going to happen. Okay. And we know two things. So inflation has to end, and you have to make the standard model. Okay. You know that has to happen. And what this means is, the rough picture is after inflation ends, you should have this oscillating amplitude field, okay? And in order to make particles, it has to couple two particles somehow, okay? So if you just take a super simple model that looks like this, okay. During inflation, pi is going to be our amplitude, it's more or less constant. And then after inflation, it starts oscillating like this one, okay? And so now we can ask, okay, what happens to this other field, chi, that the amplitudes give its energy to. Okay. So this was worked out back in the 90s by Kaufman, Lindy, and Starobinsky. Okay. And so if you write down the equation for the fluctuations in the chi field, it looks something like this. Okay. And the important thing here is that there's an oscillating time-dependent phase. Okay. And so anytime you write down these types of equations, so K theory tells you there will be exponentially unstable solutions for certain values of the parameters. Okay. And so for this particular model, you will get an instability chart that looks something like this. Okay. So red regions are very unstable, blue regions are, there's no instability. And what will happen is particular modes of the field will grow exponentially fast. Okay. So this was for a specific model, obviously. Of course, all we really need to have this effect happen is some dynamical field with an oscillating time-dependent mass. And in order to do that, you usually need some field to make that oscillating mass, okay? But again, remember, inflation has to end, so you need an oscillating inflaton, and the inflaton also has to decay, which means it has to couple to other stuff, okay? So this is basically a completely generic consequence of saying inflation ends, okay? And so this leads to all sorts of instabilities. Okay, you can have the resonant ones that come from the sine type oscillations. You can have tachyonic things where the effective mass of some field becomes tachyonic. you can have multiple input times and this will still work. Okay. And so what will happen is, at the linear level, you keep making these fluctuations, and they grow and grow and grow, and eventually they get pretty big. And then you can't do linear theory anymore. And at this point, you have to do something like numerics. Okay. So most of the results I show are going to be done using really highly parallel lattice simulations, which have terrific accuracy in time. Okay, and they're symplectic, which is important here because the way we write the equations down, symplectic integrators preserve the Hubble constraint with very, very high accuracy. Okay. And we care about the expansion rate of the universe. We better have the Hubble constraint enforced properly, or you're going to get that completely wrong. Okay. And from this point of view, the quantum fluctuations are just going to be some realization of a random field. So just some technical details about what's being done. Okay. So we're going to take our metric to be the usual thing, homogeneous, isotropic, in conformal time, and standard kinetic terms are homogeneous in matter fields. Okay. And these end up being the equations that we solve. So phi A here is canonical momentum associated with the scale factor A, and the pi I are the canonical momentum associated with the fields. Okay. And again, you just initialize some random field, Gaussian random field with these variables. Okay. So then you push go, and you can ask,
John, are you doing this? Is everything you're going to show on scale smaller than the horizon?
That will basically be where the relevant physics is happening.
I'm just asking because the fluctuations you're choosing are clearly sub-horizon initial conditions. Are you
evolving? Oh, yeah. No. So for the, you take a spectrum that's like Minkowski vacuum, essentially.
So you're doing the sub-horizon simulations on this?
More or less. So you can make them super-horizon and put in the fluctuations.
Are you also perturbing the metric at the same time? Or?
No. So it is assumed homogeneous. I will get to how you can have a perturbed metric within this framework very shortly. Okay. So again, we're doing sub-horizon stuff, so you don't really expect the gravitational fluctuations to be very big relative
to the
field.
It's gauge-dependent, I guess. I mean, in certain gauges where it's...
Yeah, okay. So we're going to gauge where gravity's homogeneous.
What's the difference between your simulations and the one that were done long ago by that shape?
So there are many things that are better. So we have better stencil for the derivatives. The time integration is much, much more accurate. Okay. And this is like completely parallel, so it can run on essentially arbitrarily sized things. The things you get from having better computation as well as better numerical integration. Yes. Okay.
Right. Is there anything new in your setup from what other people have done, or is it basically just solving the equations better?
So for here, it's going to be models that people have looked at a long time ago. I mean, I've run things that, you know, are newish models. Once you have a potential, it's not really hard to rerun everything. Right?
So what you have in here is both nonlinear classical evolution, but also the events of particle production that are involved in the parametric regime.
Yeah.
Yeah, both of those in there.
Yeah, so the whole idea behind doing a lattice simulation is that in the linear regime, you're pumping the fluctuations to be very large. And so as a result, they should become classical. And at that point, you can go into the classical wave picture. The quantum effects sort of become negligible to a certain extent. And at that point, you can start solving just the full nonlinear field equations. So as long as that transition happens, well, linear theory is still good. The evolution of the quantum modes is the same as just solving classical equations for the remote functions. Does that make sense?
Okay. I mean, that statement is true even if what you were computing was a quantum particle conduction.
Yeah, so this will not be accurate if the amount of power in the fluctuations is very small. Okay. So if the dynamically important stuff in the system is all the fluctuations that are barely occupied, then it can't be classical.
But
But the setup is associated with the expansion and annihilation creation operators for the initial conditions here, as well as the background field. And then the nonlinear dynamics is fully entangling that, so then all of the K modes are becoming strongly interacting, and that is not being described in a fully quantum mechanical way, but the classical evolution of that should be highly accurate with the occupations, the initial occupations, being given by what AK adjoint is doing. But I would challenge anybody to do a fully quantum mechanical simulation of a fully non-equilibrium non-linear field theory. That would require a lattice calculation, which would be rather dramatic, but I don't think
so I will say, so people have done the 2PI one-over-n extension, and they did the quantum version of that and checked the classical lattice simulations, and they're really not, except for the tail where there's no power.
But it's Jürgen Berger's group, or? That is Jürgen Berger's group?
Yeah. Yeah. Now, you need a one-over-n parameter. Alright, any more questions?
Parametric resonance sort of exponentially amplifies the number of modes that are created.
Yes.
So I understand that once you have a lot of modes, the whole thing could be treated classically. But I'm still confused about whether quantum effects will continue to amplify it.
The only thing really missing in this picture is commutators between A and A dagger. Because A and A dagger are here, they are random field operators essentially, but if you really care about commutators, then you are quantum. And if you don't, then this is good enough.
There are two implications. The first is that when interactions are negligible, then you can really show that the quantum equations are exactly the same as the classical equations. So that's of course the first important thing.
And so that's what's
so that is for the initial phase where you need that in a certain sense. And then once you have high occupation numbers, quantum corrections are just small, and that can be checked numerically by 2PI and things that has been done. So I think from that side, it's rather safe.
Yes. So you do need a stage where you have linear theory being good while you're amplifying the fluctuation. And that puts you into the classical regime. But that problem is the same classical and quantum mechanically, basically.
It's a quantum effect. There's no question that it's a quantum effect.
So from this point of view, it's the quantum effect that you put fluctuations into something. So if there were no fluctuations, you just have a homogeneous oscillating field.
Perhaps it's also useful to say that there is no difference in principle between quantum and classical. I mean, you just study the time evolution of correlation functions in a more general framework. So that's both in quantum and in classical, and you have some set of equations, so where you have typical quantum effects in them. And if they are small, then the classical ones are good. And of course, you do not need to have this to go by correlation functions. You can also go to real space, and that is what these lattice simulations do. But I think what I really want to emphasize, there is no a priori conceptual difference how to treat these problems in the quantum theory and the classical theory.
I completely agree with that. And not only that, I think that the standard Polyakov particle production picture is actually, this is a better way to do it. Because what you're doing with the Polyakov is you are actually trying to find new modes which are linear combinations. And so you're doing things which are sort of pretty much fooling around with the particles being most fun concepts. And when it's completely dressed, it's not clear how good that description is. We have particles that are very good in the end, but they aren't the initial fields you begin with. They get highly entangled with each other.
Okay. All right. So here, what I'm plotting is the logarithm of the energy density, okay, over a cube, okay, and red means over dense, blue is under dense, okay. And so you can see that initially there's basically no fluctuations, and they build up, and there's some coherence when they're first building up, and then suddenly they randomize themselves. Okay. And then it stays like this for a long, long, long time. You have big fluctuations that just don't go away.
This is not the most generic thing. Localized objects can exist and they can stay around for a long time.
Yeah. Depends on the potential. Yeah. I agree. In this model, you do not get coherent things at zero. So what that basically was you take one Hubble patch, you say it has uniform metric in it, okay, and then you evolve it forward in time, okay? So you can take that point of view and say, well, okay, there's separate universe picture in delta n, okay. And so I can start a bunch of different cubes, all with some epsilon equals one hypersurface there, okay? And then I can evolve them forward in time, okay? And the usual way to think about this is that you should stop doing delta n when you approach an n. So one of the points of this talk will be that for some classes of models, you can actually extend that point of view further on past the end of inflation up until the point when all of the nonlinearities in the field become perfect. Okay? So this picture gets extended from where you normally stop it to a later time. And that later time will be characterized by entropy production, basically. Okay. And so, yeah?
Sorry. Since we're now talking about metric fluctuations, maybe I can ask again. Because so in delta n, you're choosing a spatially flat slice to begin with, and then you're mapping it at late times to a different gauge in some sense.
Yeah. So we track h, we track rho.
Yeah.
So at a later time, you can stop it at a constant density surface, and that will give you zeta.
But is the idea that the simulation gives you the initial condition on the spatially flat slice for zeta, and then the supervised evolution is given by the delta n formula, or what?
So the idea is you start the field so that basically you're starting with the same field values in each individual cube, up to, you know, you have some isocurvature modes or whatever. Okay, then you run them forward and you get some evolution for log a. And then you wait until some late time and you say, okay, I'm going to stop it when rho hits whatever hit, and I'm going to measure what it is. Okay, and you do that for each cube. And that then will convert into zeta.
I guess I'm just asking because since you're saying the simulation doesn't have metric fluctuations, so at some order it's not solving the first order constraint equations or something like that, because you have matter fluctuations but not metric fluctuations. What you're saying,
so if you think nonlinear gravity is important on subhorizon scales, then yes, you should be worried. But it is very unlikely that the gravitational interactions are more important than the field interactions. On subhorizon scales.
Essentially, what we're dealing with is sound waves, and the self-gravity in the sound waves is not that important in this nonlinear field regime. So when you have an expanding universe with significant density fluctuations, then the back action of the gravitational field with the density perturbation swamps the sound propagation effects, and that gives you the usual instability. Here, the issues that you're referring to are all done on super horizon scales. The horizon scale is about a centimeter co-moving, and so all of the different patches, which we're treating as basically independently, they're all tied together by these long wavelength fields, but for the simulation purposes, you don't have to put them in. The other thing that we've done, which Jonathan referred to, is that we have put in, as well as this sort of tying together very long wavelength field, enough of the short distance fluctuations to be able to make sure that the results we get are independent of that. So what actually happens is that the power spectrum crashes down enormously as you go to these really short distance scales. And it adds a little bit of fluctuations, which can be built up on, but not so much as to change the results. So we get basically the same answer whether we include those or don't.
Yeah. To put the numbers in, basically, although the matter density over the average can be like a factor of 100, Newtonian gravitational potential dimensionless is like 10 to the minus 3, picking out the transition, and then it's gone because it's all radiation elimination. So it's really tiny on sub-horizon scales.
You could do it, you could just write down longitudinal gauge equations of motion, but that's a waste of cycles, essentially.
But what is done is that you look at the linear response to the gravitational field to this turmoil, because, for example, that can give you the gravity wave signals there, and that has been done, and that is in the sense of post-processing. The question is whether you actually have to self-couple, and the answer is that we have is that you don't have to self-couple.
If I was running very, very large boxes, like many, many Hubbles, then yes. Not having gravitational perturbations is probably bad.
Age, but no question you would have to do that. But essentially, we're using the nonlinear longitudinal gauge, and in that, the gravitational back actions are not going to be a significant effect.
I mean, the worst case would be if you gauge away the matter fluctuations, then of course the metric is in the zeta gauge.
Yeah. Yeah. And then it would be the fall.
Sorry, so the initial slice that you're starting off, different Hubble patches, they have same value, you said different
value. Same value of phi and phi dot. So I'll get to what exactly the model is?
No, it's phi and phi dot are according to end of inflation consideration.
So you said epsilon.
But there was a chi that appears, which is, from quantum fluctuations, the usual effect, there are these isocurvature degrees of freedom, which have, long wavelength aspects, and, this is actually going to be the point of this talk.
I will get to exactly how they were set.
Okay.
This is a totally irrelevant thing if you have one field, basically. So that's basically how we go from having lattices again. One Hubble-sized lattice, propagate it forward, see what it does. Okay. And so we can take a very simple model, which is just lambda phi 4, and couple it to another field chi with a phi squared coupling.
Okay. I can
just
roll that out.
No, actually.
So I'm going to say this does not have to be the inflationary potential, right? This only has to be at the bottom of the well. This is the only place we care. So you can say phi 4 is no good, but fine, I'll just connect this to some other potential log values.
Conformal coupling or square root.
Splitting
it up.
This only has to be
good.
It's actually a pretty.
This is not only this model that it's.
It has not escaped our notice. That the point is challenged.
Well, it's challenged for many reasons.
Yes, right. And so the framework that we're fooling around with now, in which this one does fit, is, for example, an overall V of R, where R is phi squared plus chi squared, and an angular dependence, and then that's what this would have. And so the vision would then be that you've got, a radial field, and then at the end of inflation, you're opening up these angular degrees of freedom. So that's one realization of that, but there are a lot. And our main point these days, which we haven't checked all models, is that the phenomenon we're talking about can be very, very generic, and it will satisfy all bounds, and it is not even unnatural in some sense.
Anyway, I will show another model that you maybe will believe more. Maybe you won't. So this has the nice property that there's a simple quantity you can track. It's basically this is what's nice about this particular model. Okay. So what you do is you take phi and you set phi and phi dot basically so that epsilon equals 1, where epsilon is a slow roll parameter. And then you say, okay, I is some field that had super Hubble fluctuations. Okay. So my initial condition is also going to contain an initial value of pi. And then you can stick it on the slow roll tractor if you want. You can do whatever. And now you're going to let that initial value of pi vary. Okay. And you're going to measure how many E folds of expansion do I get, basically, from that point epsilon equals 1 until some late time, and then check the differences between different rows. And this is not particularly clear, but there's a lot of spikes in here. Where if you happen to choose just this value of chi I, you get a perturbation of order 10 to the minus 4, 10 to the minus 5 in delta 1 a. Now, of course, you should be averaging over sub-horizon fluctuations when you do this. Okay. And so when you do that, you sort of average, you basically can involve this spiky thing, this one goes internal, and you'll get this line that looks instead of like this. Okay? So what we basically have is we're starting with some, say, inflation generates a curvature perturbation, and then we have some nonlinear function that takes this initial Gaussian random field chi and converts it into theta perturbations through preheating. Okay. So this field does not have to in any way be coupled to that field. And so this relaxes constraints on Planck data. And also, because f and l can be some really weird looking function, you can get very cool looking maps if I get to eventually. Okay.
What sets the scales that do have structure? The end, the right side?
Which part?
It goes up and down.
The U naught.
He's asking about how.
So the red thing isn't totally flat, it has structure at the far end. So what?
Oh, here.
Why does it do that?
So this is log A. Log
chi. Right. So you have
constant
your sub-horizon fluctuations are constant width and chi. So as you're doing the convolution, as you're going along here, you get lots and lots and lots of spikes, and your thing's very wide. And then as it goes out, it becomes narrower and narrower and narrower. So when you get to here, it's sort of like, well, I happen to get this spike in my convolution. You'll maybe get one or two other spikes. Okay. And then if you keep going out, eventually this will get really, really, really spiky again.
So is there randomness there, or is it just the theory, this particular theory puts the spikes in these
places? Okay. So there's a spacing where all the spikes are.
Okay, which I will explain momentarily.
So there is a periodicity in where the spikes are located.
Okay. In terms of if you wanted to start from first principles and not have a computer and say the value will be here, probably good luck. But it's easier to run code and actually figure out what the values are.
Just to comment though, see that blue line fluctuations there? So what that red line is targeting is the large scale structure regime. And so what is being marginalized over are high frequency components of the field chi. And so that's how the red response occurs. So, and there are about 50 e-foldings between the short distance and, you know, the sort of scale of large-scale structure. And so what happens is that for these smaller values, you can see that you get something that actually has a little bit of chi-squared curvature to it as well. And then things get more complicated further out, which in some respects might be the most interesting regime.
So just to be clear, where does this contribute power to the curvature power spectrum? Is this on very large k? So in Fourier space. This isn't going to change the CMB, for example, right? This is just going to change.
You'll see how it changes.
Okay.
There are pictures.
Depends on the power and the price.
It depends on where the chi power is, but.
If you have large scale power in chi, you'll have large scale power in the function of it.
Yeah, the lowest order thing that can happen is FNL happens to be in the linear regime in which you would have a biasing function times chi. That would give you two Gaussian random fields, and the second Gaussian random field would be associated with chi. And so that would give you a direct, uncorrelated addition to the power, so you would be constrained in that. But because of the complexity of FNL, it's a lot more interesting than just that linear response.
What's the spectrum of the chi field? Is it just one fluctuating, or do you have to put in the long wavelength spectrum of the chi field?
That depends on inflation, right? At some level, it's totally decoupled from inflation. It's, you know, there's some isocurvature mode that was created during inflation. Okay. So this potential, in principle, has nothing to do with what inflation is. But if you assume that this potential is always good, then you can actually compete with the spectrum.
Of the cut.
It's, you know, sort of scale invariant ish. Right? But again, that is in principle completely decoupled from what the minimum of the potential looks like.
So do you have an analytical formula to derive a asymptotic value? The fact that chi linear Wernicke-Planck factor 2x time is equal to 10 times 10 to the minus 5. There should be a simple scaling formula in each of that or not?
There should be. We don't have it.
That's, I mean, 10 to 7 is easy. It's how much you generate per epoch. That's h over 2 pi, essentially, right? That is 10 to the minus 7. More entertaining question is why it is 10 to the minus 5 in amplitude of modulation, which is about the same as, of course, like, you know, the CB1, but it has little to do with actual, like, you know, input on physics here. Now, this has, like, happens to be related to actually what the nonlinear thing is doing. So it's a separate number. And in different models, it can come out probably different.
But we have a theory we're trying to
Yes, but we have a theory.
Which is semi-analytic. There's nothing analytic in this world anymore. In which it's understood in the caustic language, which we're about to unveil.
Yes. OK. Anyway. So what's happening is, if you study the instability structure of this particular model, you'll find that the zero mode is unstable. Okay. And what that means is, until the fluctuations become important, you can just say, I have a homogeneous phi, I have a homogeneous chi, they bounce around and do whatever. Okay. And that means you have a particle bouncing around with some potential that looks like this. Okay. And so, for the trajectory, for the values of chi I, they do not give you a spike. If you look at what the motion of the particle in this billiard is, it basically just bounces around. You don't hear it, it gets too far away from chi and zero. But there are very special values, such that as you're bouncing around in here, you happen to reflect in such a way that you go out in the arm. Okay? And so then you go out in the arm, and it, meanwhile, while this is going on, you're growing fluctuations in the field, and at some point, those become important, and then suddenly you have the full nonlinear dynamics. Okay, and this picture of just homogeneous fields is no good. But when this happens and the homogeneous picture is still fine, you've already encrypted the fact that you're going to have a spike in delta n, basically. Okay. And so from this point of view, okay, the reason that you had that periodicity with the spikes is just that if you were to say that I'm going to take one of these chi field, one of these chi values that ends up in the arm, okay, and I let it run over one period so that it grows by whatever okay exponent is because it's an unstable mode, that new trajectory will also end up in the arm because it's just delayed by one bouncing back and forth on the bottom, okay? And so that is why you get this periodicity with the spikes. Now, if you wanted to figure out exactly where all the spikes are, analytically, you have to figure out exactly where you have to start up here such that you end up in that arc. Okay? And that's very, very long. So not so easy to do analytically. Okay. So that's basically what happens. And now what we have found is that, as I said before, you can basically understand where all these delta n's are coming from just by doing the dynamics of homogeneous phi and homogeneous chi. And so if you were to imagine saying, I'm going to take a bunch of trajectories, and I'm just going to perturb the chi value for them, and you'll get some string that bounces around in k-space. Okay, and now you can let it go. And if you ask, what is this going to do? Well, you've got bundles of k-space trajectories that are bouncing around in the bottom of the well, and those can, in general, focus and defocus. Okay, and when they focus, you'll get things like caustics. Okay? And so the spikes essentially correspond to caustics in one particular direction of your field space that I will define very soon. Okay? So these are real things, of course. You can go out and take pictures of them from, where was this on?
That's actually symmetry, not too far from here.
Yes, okay. So this is water and light shining in. Okay, so light rays are propagating through the water. They focus and defocus, and everywhere you see a bright spot is a cluster. Okay? Of course, this is also very popular in dark matter because you have a phase sheet and then it starts folding up and you project down into the density, you will have caustics from the sheet is folding. Okay? All right. So now we can look at how do the trajectories in the variable I told you we were going to use, k squared h,
Okay. So this is why the lambda phi 4 u squared phi squared chi squared is nice. A squared h, if you time average, so you get rid of the oscillations in the background, is a constant. Okay. And that's just because that model has no dimensional value. Okay. And so you're going to measure ln A at a constant h vector surface. So that quantity will directly encode perturbations in A. Okay. So this is why that particular model is really nice. And so here we've got basically the initial value of chi time. And the color coding is how much does A squared h change as a function of time if I change the initial value of chi. Okay. So everywhere this thing goes to zero, basically you'll have trajectories that are converging with each other. And wherever it's big, they're tending to diverge very rapidly. Okay? And so you can see there are lots of zeros in here. Okay. If you zoom in, you'll see even more. There's a lot of fractal structure. Cool. Okay. And so again, there's some peaks in here. Okay. So if I now look at what A squared H looks like, okay, which again is encoding delta ln A, you will see there are these big spikes in it, okay, which correspond to where all those constants are. Okay. And so now, if you were to just say that the individual trajectories don't talk to each other, so the gradient terms aren't important, what you would do to get the expectation value for A squared H is you would just integrate the probability distribution of A squared H times A squared H. Okay. And that is what's being done up here. Okay. And as you can see, all these spiky structures, okay? And this is just running trajectories for homogeneous structure. There's no gradient terms at all. Okay. And if you take the spikes that we got from doing full lattice simulations, they overlap with where all these things are. Before this gets going too far, this is kind of a dense figure, so okay. What this is showing is basically we're going to start out a bunch of trajectories where every single field variable is the same, except for the chi-i's, okay? And then you adjust h so that you're still satisfying the Hubble constraint. So here we've got the potential, and this direction is chi, this direction is phi, okay. This thing is, if I were to take, so this string is moving around in some 60-degree space, okay. If you project it back down into this plane, and then, so it's going to in general be some really complicated tangled up thing, you untangle it and then uniformly compress it, label where you are by the initial value of chi, you can then say what's the probability distribution at that point relative to what it was when I started. Okay. So that's projecting into this plane. You can also, however, project into the gravitational plane. So ln A and A squared H. Okay. And as it's running, I've basically scaled the ln A axis so that that thing looks, it's the same length for all time. Okay. And then you can take this thing and project it into the A squared H axis. And so this is going to be basically what I'm going to call the probability stream density. So if you were to start at this end of the string, okay, go along, you can ask, okay, when I project that part of the string down onto A squared H, what is the probability associated with that little piece of string? Okay, and that's going to be plotted here. And you're going to see caustics develop and spikes, and so at each point in general, there will be more than one line. Okay, those just correspond to the different streams. So the string is its swirling around. And so if you wanted the total probability, again, you just add them all. Okay. So again, there are things bouncing around in here. Okay. The initial chi distribution is just so small that you can't see it. Okay. Now you can see it's starting to spread out. Okay. You can see the string sort of stretching. And now it's going to bounce around. And where did it go now? So some of the trajectories get up in this arm, and some of them get up in this arm, and some of them don't. Okay. And maybe I should rewind a little bit. So as this is going, you'll see spikes start to develop on this thing. So this is caustics in the phi chi plane. And soon something interesting will happen. Okay.
So here you can start to see these spikes develop. And the thing continue to fold and fold and fold. Okay. So if you've ever looked at one-dimensional gravitational simulations, and you look at how the energy density develops as the structure is collapsing, it will look very much like this. So far, this entire picture has been no interactions between the different lattice sites. So you're just taking the separate universe picture, extending it past the end of inflation, and now saying I can just treat all those trajectories on sub-horizon scales as ballistic trajectories and don't talk to each other, and I can do an average and get the result. Okay. Now, this obviously breaks at some point. Okay. At some point, all those gradients and all the trajectories on sub-horizon scales are going to start to talk to each other. Okay. And so you need to know when to stop doing this. And so really quickly, going to say a few things. So the point that you want to stop is going to be defined by when the entropy suddenly gets big. Okay. So if you have some arbitrary field and you want to define its entropy, you can just define it to be the Shannon entropy, where this P is some probability density functional of the field. Okay, so it's some horrible, horrible thing. You have no idea what it is. Okay. So the question is, how do I take this formula and turn it into an actual number? Okay. And the basic idea is just, you say, I'm going to measure certain things about the system. Okay. And then I'm going to maximize that entropy functional subject to constraining the P to satisfy all those things that I can measure. And so when you do that, if you say that all you're going to do is measure the power spectrum, or because it's homogeneous field, the covariance matrix, you will find that you should assume that your probability your PDF is a multivariate Gaussian. And the entropy will have a form that looks like this. So basically, you just sum up the power, log of the power. Sorry. Yeah. And so we're going to take the field whose entropy we're measuring to be the log of the energy density. Okay. And so the reason I'm going to do this instead of the field variables will be clear very soon. So one thing to say is that this is a measurable quantity. It's also a conserved quantity. So, you know, at late times, you sort of expect the conserved quantities that are being transported around to be relevant. And you don't know that rho can't be against the field. It has to be positive. Okay. So long rho does not have this problem. All right. Of course, better motivation is that if you go and measure the one-point PDF of rho over rho bar, you will find that it is a log normal distribution with very good accuracy. Okay. So this blue line is a log normal fit. And all the colored lines are the actual one-point PDF measured from some other one. Okay. So at least the one-point PDF doesn't kill you. Okay. But you can do much better than this. Okay. You can go to Fourier space and ask, okay, I'm going to measure the excess kurtosis wave number by wave number by wave number. I'm going to see what it does. So on the bottom is the power spectrum. Okay. On the top is the excess kurtosis. So initially, you have linear growth of the fluctuations, which is down at the low k end there. So the background field is oscillating around, you're growing power, 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 and then at some point, very quickly, you grow this long tail. Okay? And at the same time, the field becomes very Gaussian if you look at the three-point. Fourier mode by Fourier mode. Okay? Okay. And just one more thing, okay. You can also plot the PDF, okay, for like the lower Fourier modes and see what it does. And so this green is again a Gaussian, okay, and the red, whatever it is what's coming out of the simulation.
Okay, what's changing in time?
Yeah, this is as a function of time. So you can see at some point you go off, and this is basically when all the nonlinearity kicks in. And then really quickly it settles down to being very close to Gaussian. Okay. Right. So. And so basically this gives you some suggestion that the long rho over rho bar modes are the things that are actually very close to being Gaussian fields. Okay. Okay, so these are in some sense the simple degrees of freedom in your system, as opposed to phi and chi, and pi phi and pi chi, which are horribly, horribly complicated and tangled up with each other.
Okay. Sorry, John, can I also link in? You're talking about initially started up by saying you wanted a condition where you should stop treating each lattice point as being independent.
Yep.
And then you were now talking about.
Very quickly, I'm going to get to that. It's just how to define that surface.
And
so
yes,
why are we defining it this particular way?
Why are you defining the end point in this particular way?
Why are we defining entropy in this field? And we're going to define the end point with entropy. So it's important to actually understand why we're doing it this way. Having said that, it doesn't really matter. You can do it with the fields, do the same thing, and the effect I'm about to show doesn't change.
Low k's and higher k's. Is the crossover there basically the scale of the original particle
function
of pi up?
So sure, if you want that. I can plot that PDF for different k bins.
So
it does the same thing.
What you were saying.
It was, but
I just chose a bin.
Different k bands still remarkably obey this law.
You can bin it in k.
Means that, you know, with all of the complications of this development system. Mm-hmm. Phonons, as defined by log rho, are simple variables. I mean, you know, they are going to have higher points, as you pointed out, but it's very, very subdominant, whereas in the phi and chi, it's really dominant. So for some reason, the basic conserved quantity, which is the total stress energy tensor, is the one that the system really likes to express itself in. And so those are the better variables that don't cut. Might also say that there are better variables in inflation too, but that's another story.
Yeah. So basically, you saw before that the power spectrum grows its tail really quickly. And so what that means is that if you're studying this entropy, you define the maximum entropy technique. Okay. So the top is plotting ds by dt. Okay. There is this one point where ds dt has this big spike and then it goes down to zero, basically. And this corresponds to also the variance in rho over rho bar. Okay. So this is 1 over the variance. And it also corresponds to this quantity, which is sort of like delta. It also corresponds to wing rho. So we decided to call this point where all the entropy gets produced the shock in time. Okay. And this is basically the point when all the nonlinearities in the system become important and all the different trajectories start talking to each other. So this defines the surface that you should stop the ballistics.
This again, as you said, even if I just compared the variance of the fields compared to the homogeneous value, this would give you the same point.
This would basically be
the same point.
But entropy is a nice word to say. So.
The other thing I was just going to with, sorry. The idea of this log normality is not completely universal. Easy to construct systems where you don't get.
Yes, so if you had oscillons that are sitting in there, yes, then okay.
But this
but then it's like there's some, but that's saying that the correct degrees of freedom, if you have these localized blobs of things flying around, is not the energy density. It's like the positions of those blobs.
Might, because the blobs actually will be different sizes as well and distributed. So.
Yeah, so the appropriate variables there are obviously going to be something to do with those coherent structures that you have. So yes, you can find models where it will not go to log normal, but here it does.
And we get that with different models. For example, there's field theory with a different potential. I hope I'm going to get to it. So it's a model in which you roll down and you have something that can create, I would call them pseudo-strings at the end of inflation, so they're stringy-like configurations. That changes the equation of state because you get some long-lived aspect oscillons, another example. And what that does, it changes the long-term modulation after the shock. It doesn't change that there's a shock. So I guess the description
is... So what you would see is there's this...
Yeah.
Corresponds to the decay.
Yeah, the entropy production then occurs over a longer time, but the thing that is not modified in any of these models that we've seen is this incredibly sharp eyes.
But I would put it, yeah, absolutely.
So if we look at this on a spike, okay. So let's plot A to the fourth row, which again, a constant row is going to encode delta 1A. Okay. And so this blue line, black, okay. This is A to the fourth row, smoothed over time, so it gets rid of all the oscillations in the plane. It basically goes to a constant value. And this red thing is where the shock happens. Okay. So essentially, this will encode that, okay, stop doing the ballistic evolution here, but you've already imprinted the fact that you're going to have delta line beforehand. Okay. And you can actually check this for different values of chi I. Okay. So the color scheme is A to the fourth row, okay, minus some fiducial value, so I'm perturbing it around zero. And the yellow line is when the shock happens. Okay. So you can see the value of A to the fourth row with the shock correlates very, very well with the wait time value. And so what this essentially does is it does all the mixing for you by just coupling all the different trajectories together. And once you've done that, when you actually, that is essentially taking those very spiky A squared H things, doing the smoothing for you, and then you actually pull out all the spikes that you have. Given that, we now have some complicated function that takes some initial field and maps it off into some adiabatic density perturbations. Okay. And it looks like this. So you can go ahead and say, what is this going to look like if I put it onto this guy? Okay. So these are going to be snapshots to different values of mean chi I. Okay. So different points on this curve. And so this is always taking exactly the same background field that you're mapping, okay? So if you get this, if you change the value, suddenly you pull out a bunch of structure, okay? Which may or may not look like something that's in there, okay?
So maybe we should make sure that the control variables are, so there's...
Okay, I'll be very quick. So what happens is, you look at super horizon scales, basically, there's a mean chi, okay? Like super horizon. And then around that, there will be basically for each pixel some mean value of chi that is in there that amounts to smooth the universe over that size of the pixel. Okay. So you now have a distribution in chi that is the super, super Hubble size chi plus some fluctuations around it. Okay. And you take that map, run it through FNL, okay, varying what the mean chi that you're fluctuating around is, and it gets stuck to it.
So sorry, I still don't understand what sets that distribution of the chi field on super horizon scales. How do you, what are you choosing? What
sets that distribution?
The open question is, so we have the characteristic scale of the observed horizon now,
right.
But outside of that, there are presumably a huge number of equilibriums that are associated with stochastic inflation, for example. How far that extends is an open question. That is the thing that is quite dramatic about this specific model. So if you think about all of the chi's with large-scale structure, the distribution of the chi's, if you go to, you know, 10 to the 21 megaparsecs or something, okay. You know, I mean, really get big because it can be so, especially in models that can give you effectively eternal inflation. There are about the amplitude of the root mean square fluctuation is about five times the amplitude that would be in that large scale structure region. So what that means is that you have this huge distribution that you're just throwing the dice on, and you're grabbing one of those values, and you're saying that corresponds to this guy, and then you've got to another value, and it corresponds to one of the other guys is going to show. And so it's all directly computable from the specific form of the interaction potential. The open question is how far you let those excursions go on in this curvature mode. But it's a very remarkable thing when we first tripped over this, which is that there is a way, except unfortunately only one way for our universe, but there is a way to access this super duper ultra large scale structure of the universe. Unfortunately, it's just with one value. Or if there's a little bit more, you can do a gradient expansion and get low order dipoles and quadrupoles, which is one of the things that you might not surprise Komatsu here that we're playing with now in regard to certain data, which is just.
So which of the anomalies are you?
We're in progress. Let's yes. call it that. We want to correlate more than one of them together.
This is a purely theoretical exercise.
Yeah.
We don't care what happens out of the sky. This will just happen. We can't get them all, at least not yet.
So you probably already explained this, but the L dependence of these anomalies.
So the underlying isocurvature field has a spectrum which is not quite flat. It actually starts to downturn with this specific interaction potential, but it's pretty flat. So it's essentially like a nearly Gaussian random field, which is realized. But then what you do is you do this huge amplifier, which gives you this spiky behavior in field space. Because we're marginalizing over short distances, you don't get a short distance when you're looking at the microwave sky because there's an actual filter. So the fluctuations, at least in structure, are well defined. Then the question is, with this super large scale parameter, how does it look as you vary that super large scale parameter, which is the value of the field there? And so you'll see that it's actually quite dramatic.
I'm still slightly confused. So this depends on pi squared chi squared being the interaction and the value.
Our point is that it does have that for this specific model. Certain people like Eva would say, how can you still be dealing with a lambda divided by pi squared chi squared? And yes, we're sensitive to that point, and we're at the beginning. But you can do it with supersymmetric inspired models, and there are a whole
right,
class.
But you need to specify the interaction for all values of phi and chi.
Explicitly the power spectrum over the observable range. You have to have a model that gives you that power spectrum. But it's a light, at least in this model, it's a light isocurvature field. Not really heavy, it's a light one, and then it develops its heaviness through the interaction with phi.
So you're saying that it's probes super, super, super horizon scale. So yeah. How far into the inflation part of the potential as opposed to the oscillating part of the potential does it depend on?
Well, no, but if it's a light cable, it will depend. Have a really characteristic power spectrum. Right?
I mean, that has nothing to do with the phi.
And what you're saying is true if it gets really heavy and where its distance is, but if it's light fields. I mean, that's the remarkable thing, is that there could be thousands of these really light fields that are sitting around that are getting their quantum oscillations, just like the gravitational field. And the question is, what are they good for? And, in a strict isocurvature framework of axionic, et cetera, Planck ruled out a certain amount of that because we couldn't get away with it in the power spectrum. But this is a way to make use of it that still can be viable and does actually very dramatic things. But those things, they're there, and it would be interesting to access them. And this may be one way.
I missed something. For what value of F and L is this? Or is this allowing F and L to vary?
F and L is a function.
Allows it to vary.
Right. FNL is a function of the super horizon value of tau. Okay. So you take like the entire super horizon universe and pick out what the chi value is there. And then FNL is a function. Okay. So these are for different values.
Going back to that, so what we have is chi greater than horizon. And then there's the distribution, which is the sort of random fluctuations between whatever you define the large-scale structure scale and the horizon that causes a distribution which is a Gaussian distribution around each of the, you know, each of that red.
So you pick a point here, and then you sample.
Yeah, that's right.
What are the axes labeled here? What's been plotted?
So the vector is what we care about. So this is just that function.
And what's on the bottom, the x-axis?
This is
I. So the reason we plotted f prime and f prime prime is that the first thing you would say is I'm going to go in and I'm going to relate this to what Planck already did, and WMAP did so well before, which is that you're doing in that a quadratic expansion about each of the points. And so you'd say, well, then I can just translate this into, you know, the standard constant FNL constraints. But here, those are weakened enormously, not that the observed value is weakened, but that it's effectively weakened because you have the dominant adiabatic inflaton fluctuations, and then you have this subdominant term. I mean, it didn't have to be that way. It would have been kind of fun were we able to have done the entire curvature spectrum with just this phenomenon and not get anything from the inflaton. But at the moment, we don't see how we control that and still make it viable. That could be, but we don't think that we can right now. So then the other thing is that the sampling along those red lines is such that it makes the approximation of a quadratic order. It doesn't work very well. And so that's why we get this tremendously dramatic set of things that can happen on sky. So it can look like the usual small FNL expansion picture, which if you, but you can also get these very dramatic things that you're looking for. And the now intermittency is the other.
Yeah. Yeah.
What is so along the bottom is the realization of the fluctuation in delta chi?
So this is the value that your fluctuations go around.
Right. So does it depend on the realization of the fluctuation in the inflaton itself?
No, it's just a property of you have this isocurvature mode. What does its value happen to be?
On one sky, if you have about L to 1500, the spread of chi values you get is about one tick value. It's it's fairly wide. So it samples a substantial part of that function.
So if you let that background value of chi that you can put the fluctuations in around vary, this guy can change quite dramatically.
Okay. Usually when people show this plot, they show you perturbations around the average temperature. Like on this plot,
this is almost that modulo normalization I told.
But the point is on top of this.
There's also
the standard inflaton nearly Gaussian random field. This is the subdominant thing that would be underneath that you're trying to find as a pattern recognition exercise, which is not necessarily an FNL pattern.
But one thing we could say, if we go back by one slide, you can say that we just rule out. Actually, one more. So these are curves. So we just rule out, of course, it still depends on possibility, but at least the functional form of this is exactly usual FNL if chi value happens to be near zero.
Oh, yeah. If you take it this way, then
we excluded ourselves from that particular region.
But if you're over here, then it's not. That looks very interesting. So there's a constraint, but the constraint is an actual. If you are in that regime, and one of the earlier curves you showed that there is a pretty long stretch of that regime at lower values.
That's right.
So what's interesting is that the thing that you're constraining involves chi greater than the horizon cubed plus something else. But in any case, it's pretty amazing that that's what you are constraining with it. So it has to be a certain value.
So if these guys are correlated with actual CMB map, you're looking at whatever that map is buried into the random noise. It's hard to see. Like estimators will not pick up this thing very easily because you get hit essentially with no correlation on phi square. The very first one is by spectrum in these guys. This can be substantial admixture of that sort of thing. But if it's there, then it's actually can do cool things, because if you look at the maps, there is clearly power asymmetry in those things, right? There is just features in one half of it, and then there is another.
also there is thing which is always positive in delta like log n, sorry, delta n, which is log a, which always corresponds to negative temperature fluctuation. This is characteristic to this model. Maybe another way it goes other way, but also entertaining that also tends to give you, like, you know, some sort of intermittent cold scenes on the sky here and there.
Another aspect is that, not that other models aren't given, but there's a clear prediction for what the polarization properties would be in here, which would essentially be just those generated by, you know, temperature fluctuations. Can you go back to the...
To which one?
Any one of the random realizations. So where our challenge is in, you know, fooling around with this is the extent to which the short distance structure in those little intermittent patches there, whether they can be ruled out by the high L data from Planck. And so that's the thing that we don't have a handle on at all. So we're just sort of in the exploration phase. So what was different about these particular maps than what we did in the 09 paper with Kaufman is that this is actually based upon a full-up, you know, simulations where we used an approximate model for the spikes in order to show what it might look like on the sky. And what is absolutely remarkable is that it, you know, comes out to give this amazing intermittent structure like this, which is what we were shooting for. We were trying to target when we realized there was this phenomenon, the cold spot, and now there are other spots to pull around it.
Yeah, I mean, it's really, I mean, the reason I asked about the altitudes is the sort of obvious way to go with that would be to have your transit from early time, whereas for you, it's the opposite.
It's all clear, right?
The pie gets generated and then you see it.
Is it completely decorrelated from the Gaussian part? Because
it's not decorrelated from the inflaton part.
Yeah, not from the Gaussian part.
From the inflaton piece.
There's a bias times the linear there. But otherwise, yeah, it's from the
so that comes out as a traditional FNL.
Well, no, but
plus more linear terms.
Yeah,
yeah, plus more traditional.
Yeah. Yeah. So when you do FNL pattern searching, if you do it the best way, you use C inverse total as the weighting, right? And that includes obviously this effect, which is the dominant but main effect, is coming from the Gaussian adiabatic. So it's, you know, shoving everything down.
Okay. Yep. So yes, you get maps that can change quite dramatically. Okay.
You make two look the same, but the color scheme changed. What's different between those?
Apparently, it was hard to normalize the colors.
Okay, yeah. So this is after normalized color scheme,
so
right?
This is like
on the bottom bar.
But if it's saturated, like most of your sky is the heaviest color in your sky, it's hard to see what is happening.
It's not saturated, it's just not symmetrical, it's not Gaussian. That's exactly the point.
In the first plot you show, almost all the sky was the minimum blue.
Yes.
Yeah, no, but that's the whole point. It depends. If you're taking a Gaussian field and you're pumping it through some function.
Well, the other thing
is
that it's, you know, asymmetric.
This is also,
you're going from minus one up to 6.5.
This is not clear, this is actual like linear scaling. It's just that it is non-Gaussian, and that's how it looks like.
Okay. So really quickly, just to show that you can get this other way.
Okay. You can also imagine that you're going to modulate the couple with some superhorizon fields. Okay. With their light, well, this direction is changing g squared in the lambda phi 4 model. Again, you can modulate it to a g squared change. Okay. And you can take a different model that maybe you're more happy with, m squared, phi squared, okay?
Getting closer.
Which might be so, it's okay, more reasonable. Okay, this is now the timing of when that shock happens, and the equation of state changes between the before and after the shock. So as soon as you modulate the shock timing, you're gonna get a perturbation, okay? And once again, you get a lot of structure in here, okay? And so this is just saying g squared some constant in the simulation. This is actually letting the effective G be a field that is dynamical in the simulation volume. Okay. And this doesn't change very much. So this is a two field, this is a three field.
Let chi have a mass also, or a more generic potential for itself, but let's say you live out where its potential is flat. Would that be good enough for you as well? Because having these dead flat is, you would question given the interactions that you've got.
I don't need that.
Yeah, no, I think it's just the fact that when you bounce around, you're going to have chaotic motion. And in general, you're going to focus and defocus. And then it's a question of, does that project onto it, the actual expansion history? Which will depend to some extent on the template you're using.
I mean, if you make it completely like or symmetrical around the
world,
that obviously goes away. As long as you don't have like, you know, two symmetrical shapes, you can lift the flat direction and it will still be noticeable smaller amplitude. So we keep trying.
I mean, you're using it to it generates. It has to have its own fluctuations during.
Yeah, that's
it. Can't be too heavy.
It cannot be too heavy.
Yeah.
It could be out on its own potential or something. Just not.
You do need the field there to actually amplify.
Okay.
Again, you can do it with couplings. You can do it with just the field you're reheating into.
So we've only started to play with a large variety of potentials because. The code is now so lickety-split fast that we can generate entire universes in matters of days. No. but we can do a lot of model searching and checking out complex, but more interesting potentials.
And some of these figures are like, you know, millions of three-dimensional realizations. Run.
But in some sense, you now sort of telling us that you don't have to do it, right? So you just
So I would say, so to get this, this particular thing is the nonlinearity is kicking in. Okay, so you can't just see this particular thing with the background. Having said that, if I take exactly the same potential, okay, all I do is change the initial value of the reheat field and then do the background stuff again. You see this is good, and there's a bunch of structure in here. So there will be regimes where you can do the ballistics. There will be regimes.
No, but I think in terms of printing this out of the map, I think I may be wrong, but the picture I have now is that you have this delta chi which has a scaling invariant spectrum.
Mm-hmm.
Now that will be processed through by some nonlinear function,
yeah.
And that will add it on to your temperature anisotropy data. But there's more to it actually, right? So are you is that all? So there's a single
we have
function,
a dynamical
there's a
way
single
to
function over
that.
Our entire sky.
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah. Okay.
Because it's a function of.
So then the question is,
the field
how do
the
we?
It's
a
local
one-point function. So you just have one function.
Yeah. So this is all local physics, right? It's all sub-horizon.
Yeah.
So you're essentially making a point transformation of the field. So you just take the field, pump it through the function.
Yeah.
The field.
I mean, you could have it as a function of two random fields.
Oh yeah.
For example, if you vary the g squared over lambda and the chi.
Yeah. You can have sheets.
Oh, right.
You can have everything. You could have a billion fields, and then well, it's something super complicated, but.
It's local in the like local physics sense. It's literally done point wise.
Yeah.
You know, the,
but
yeah,
it's
so
a point wise transformation.
Parlance, it's local non Gaussianity, but it's a pretty dramatically different looking.
Sure, yeah. But you can write down the PDF, for example, on observed temperature PDF.
Oh, yeah.
Using that function.
There's even nice
question,
for these things.
How do you estimate that function? That's the question.
So people who do brain imaging study exactly these kind of problems where they have some local transformation. The point is you're not taking a point here and a point here and then the final field depends on that. Okay, so yeah. And again,
you're sure that there'll be one function that will be seen in four signatures.
That's the problem with the limitation. It's just there's we're in a game of who actually will decide or play the roulette.
All right. So since it is late, that's it. So the main thing to take away is that. What we need for this mechanism to work is there has to be some other field against variations on superhorizon scales. Okay, I don't care how it gets them.
And then somehow those perturbations have to affect the potential that you're rolling around in, either as an initial condition or the form of the potential or something. And if that happens, in general, you've got particle motion in some billiard, and you're going to have things like caustics form, or even the shock and time service can be mediated. And what this is going to look like is that you're taking that field and pumping it through some function. And that, in general, is going to make potentially very weird-looking intermittent localized features on the sky. Okay. And the other thing is, there's information theoretic measures that you can use to sort of study the entropy, which is telling you when you transition from ballistic to actually being localized.
It's pretty clear the pi spectrum is not the right way to do this.
Yeah, so the other thing is you can suppress the bispectrum you would get by just saying that the Gaussian piece is dominant and all the non-Gaussian is coming from this FNL function. And then there's a ratio of the power spectra squared. It will suppress whatever the FNL, little FNL if you want, that you would get from the bispectrum.
Interestingly enough, if you just, you know, take of transform of that map, like, you know, non-linear map at face value, before applying sort of transfer function just from it, it doesn't really look like it has features. So it looks like, you know, some sort of very smooth function from like L of lowish to L of high. So what it would do, it will just change normalization of overalls in this spectrum when you bury it in.
If you look at the power spectrum,
you're
dominated by the few largest features.
Yeah, but it's local, right? So those guys, like, you know, when you do the full sky Fourier transform, they will spread out, so they will become very small, and if you take half a sky, maybe they will be a little bit more focused. So who knows? That's one of the reasons why maybe it's a good thing to try to do, like, mapping estimators of FNL. Because if such a thing, like, you know, is buried in there, it would show up on them, but like, as a map.
One of the worries from a practical point of view is that if you have a field that's completely independent of them, dominant, is that, you know, any process of intermittency will look like this, right? So dust in the galaxy, you know, suddenly the thing that made it safe for the standard
energy. But there's more information here.
The correlation between,
the CV is scaling invariant. This delta chi is scaling invariant. You just have a nonlinear function, delta bar is delta chi.
Yeah, so the only thing is that, you know, really what's specific about this is that you start with a Gaussian invariant field. If you know the power history of that, then you might have a shot.
Yeah.
That being the distinguishing feature.
That's a prediction.
Right, but just look at these maps, I mean, they look kind of like dust maps.
Well, the only thing we can say now, we know the frequency spectrum of yours.
Yeah, it's
a. But it makes it a more complicated pattern recognition issue. But it's got a certain amount of predictabilities.
Yeah.
Another thing, again, which Nicole already mentioned, that if it's actually primordial potential, whole stuff flows into it, the four-wheel polarization. Right? Once the polarization data is there, and it cross-correlates with, you know, non-Gaussian anomalous things like cold spot, you might start suspecting that, you know, it might have been actual hole in the original potential. Whereas if it's some sort of foreground effect, you might not knock out polarization patterns that much.
And there's one other feature which is actually quite exciting about this. We haven't explored it as much as we should have, and now that we think it's pretty generic, it's a good thing to do. So it might not have escaped your notice, in the famous words, that there's a lot of scale between what we smoothed over, which is essentially the kind of scale that's associated with Southampton scale, down to really short distances that are actually, that the dark matter can still begin to cluster on. And so then, instead of getting that smooth transfer function, you get this spiky one. And that spiky one has a tremendously interesting aspect to it, because what it's doing, because this error is on the cold spot side, so it's actually trying to make a little dips in the Newtonian gravitational potential, which is then going to try and, so one, you know, one constraint that could be of great interest is that you know, you could get a tau constraint by having those being too important too early and making them for stars. So there is that whole interesting aspect. Now the question is it generic that you would have short distance structure and large scale structure that you can accept with C and D, that you could actually start to think about, you know, if this, then that, et cetera. My guess is no, because the coupling variations look a bit different, but it's something which is, you know, interesting. That is to say, these models will have consequences on small scales as well as the large scale.
Let's thank Jonathan for a very interesting.